Welcome to Authors on Tour Live, a weekly podcast for people who love to hear about books from the authors themselves. My name is Darren Fote, and today we're podcasting live from the Tattered Cover Bookstore, one of the premier independent bookstores in the nation, with three locations in the Metro Denver area. Tonight's author on tour is David Sedaris, who reads from and discusses his new book, When You Are Engulfed in Flames, published by Little Brown. In the weeks to come, we have David Guterson, André Debus III, and many more. You can visit www.authorsontourlive.com for a complete list of upcoming podcasts. And wait just a moment. It's time to begin.
Well, good afternoon, everyone. The time has arrived. Yeah. On behalf of the Tattered Cover Bookstore, it is my pleasure to welcome you and to thank you for your support. I would like to thank you for choosing the Tattered Cover today. You have lots of options. You could be in bed, you could be at brunch, you could be at the bar, you could be at Pride Fest, you could be at Greek Fest. There's a fest for everything going on today. You could be at the baseball stadium, but you chose to be at the Tattered Cover with David Sedaris. You also chose to purchase David Sedaris' new book, When You Are Engulfed in Flames, from the Tattered Cover. And by doing so, you enable us to bring you David today and other events like this in the future that we hope that you will continue to enjoy. We are delighted that David has returned to the Tattered Cover. Not only is he one of our favorites, but he's one of the world's favorites. You may have noticed that he is on the top of each and every single bestseller list that is out there right now. And he has made it with When You're Engulfed in Flames. So would you do me the great pleasure of joining me in welcoming David Sedaris back to the Tattered Cover.
Thank you so much for coming. That means so much to me. I'm on a book tour, and I think I started about 3 weeks ago. And what I've been doing, I got here an hour and a half early, and so a lot of people had their books signed already. And then I'll sign books afterwards, just as long as people want books signed, I'll be here. But I'm offering priority signing tonight to grown men who are 5'6" and shorter. What I've been doing is I'm starting a series of half pint clubs in different cities that I go to, and then I have officers, I have sergeant at arms, and I'm always secretary because I write. But then we have treasurers, and we have different. So the people who are 5'6" and under, the grown men, will be named officers of the club. And I'm going to been thinking about it, and the one in Denver is going to be called the club is going to be called the Mile High Mini Men. So that's who we're going to be. So when I finish the signing, if you're a grown man and you're 5'6" or under, then please, no waiting in line for you, my small friend. Your days of waiting are over. And I feel like I should have something for women, too, and I just haven't come upon it yet. Somebody suggested, and maybe we'll give that a try, but I don't have the name for it, and it would be women who are 5'10 and taller. Either that or women with sideburns. But you know what? Actually, let's try women who are 5'10 and taller, and we'll throw that in with, because there aren't that many. There aren't going to be that many, and there aren't going to be that many little wee men either. There's no. Because you don't want to, like, let's say if I said, okay, priority signing to, I don't know, like, blondes or something. That's like people would sit there and think, God damn it. You know, that's like 300 people just cut a line ahead of me. I was going to read a story from the book that was in, it was in The New Yorker not too long ago. And it's called Crybaby. The night flight to Paris leaves JFK at 7 p.m. and arrives at De Gaulle the next day at around 8:45 a.m. French time. Between takeoff and landing, there's a brief parody of an evening. Dinner is served, the trays are cleared, and 4 hours later, it's time for breakfast. The idea is to trick the body into believing it has passed a night like any other, that your unsatisfying little nap was actually sleep, and now you are rested and deserving of an omelet. Hoping to make the lie more convincing, many passengers prepare for bed. I'll watch them line up outside the bathroom, some holding toothbrushes, some dressed in slippers or loose-fitting pajama-type outfits. Their slow-footed padding gives the cabin the feel of a hospital ward. The dark aisles are corridors. The flight attendants are nurses. The hospital feeling grows even stronger once you leave coach. Up front, where the seats recline almost flat, like beds, the doted-on passengers lie under their blankets and moan. I've heard, in fact, that the airline staff often refers to the business class section as the ICU because the people there demand such constant attention. They want what their superiors are getting in first class, so they complain incessantly, hoping to get bumped up. There are only two classes on the airline I normally take between France and the United States, coach and something they call business elite. The first time I sat there, I was flown to America and back for a book tour. Really, I kept insisting, there's no need. The whole first aboard business I found a little embarrassing. But then they brought me a bowl of warm nuts, and I began to soften. The pampering takes some getting used to. A flight attendant addresses me as Mr. Sedaris, and I feel sorry that she's forced to memorize my name rather than, say, her granddaughter's cell phone number. On this particular airline, though, they do it in such a way that it seems perfectly natural, or at least it does after a time. "May I bring you a drink to go with those warm nuts, Mr. Sedaris?" the woman looking after me asked. This as the people in coach were still boarding. The looks they gave me as they passed were the looks I give when the door of a limousine opens. You always expect to see a movie star, or at the very least, someone better dressed than you. But time and time again, it's just a sloppy nobody. Thus, the look, which translates to, "Fuck you, sloppy nobody, for making me turn my head." On all my subsequent flights, the business elite section was a solid unit, but on this particular plane, it was divided in two, four rows up front and two in the back. The flight attendant assured everyone in my section that though we were technically in the back, we shouldn't think of it as the back. We had the same rights and privileges as those passengers ahead of us, yet still they were ahead of us, and I couldn't shake the feeling that they had somehow been favored. On the way to New York, I sat beside a bearded Frenchman who popped a pill shortly after takeoff and was out until we landed. On the leg back, there was no one beside me, at least not for the first half hour. Then a flight attendant knelt in the aisle beside my seat and asked if I might do her a favor. That's how they talk in business elite. "I'm wondering, Mr. Sedaris, if you might do me a favor." Chipmunk-like, my cheeks packed with warm nuts. I cocked my head. "I've got a passenger a few rows up, and his crying is disturbing the people around him. Do you think it would be okay if he sat here?" The woman was blonde and heavily made up. Glasses hung from a chain around her neck. And as she gestured to the empty window seat beside me, I got a pleasant whiff of what smelled like oatmeal cookies. "I believe he's Polish," she whispered. "That is to say, I think he's from Poland, the country." "Is he a child?" I asked. And the flight attendant told me no. "Is he drunk?" Again, she said no. "His mother just died, and he's on his way to her funeral." "So people are upset because he's crying over his dead mother?" "That's the situation." she told me. I'd once read that a first-class passenger complained, threatened to sue, if I remember correctly, because the blind person next to him was traveling with a seeing-eye dog. He wasn't allergic, this guy. Labrador retrievers on the street didn't bother him, but he hadn't paid thousands of dollars to sit next to one, or at least that was his argument. If that had seemed the last word in Ass Holiness, this was a close second. I said, of course the man could sit beside me. And the flight attendant disappeared into the darkness, returning a few minutes later with the grieving passenger. Thank you, she mouthed. And I said, no problem. The Polish man might have been in his mid-40s, but seemed older, just as people in my parents' generation had. Foreign blood or an abundance of responsibility had robbed him of the prolonged adolescence currently enjoyed by Americans of the same age. So his face, though unlined, seemed older than mine, more used. His eyes were red and swollen from crying, and his nose, which was large and many faceted, looked as if it had been roughly carved from wood and not yet sanded smooth. In the dim light, he resembled one of those elaborate, handcrafted bottle stoppers, the kindly peasant or good-natured drunk who tips his hat when you pull the string. After settling in, the man looked out the darkened window. Then he bit his lower lip, covered his face with his remarkably large hands, and proceeded to sob deeply. I felt that I should say something, but what and how? Perhaps it would be better, less embarrassing for him, if I were to pretend that he wasn't crying. To ignore him, basically. And so I did. The Polish man didn't want dinner, just waved it away with those king-sized mitts of his. But I could feel him watching as I cut into my urban-crusted chicken, most likely wondering how anyone could carry on at a time like this. That's how I felt when my mother died. The funeral took place on a Saturday afternoon in November. It was unseasonably warm that day, even for Raleigh, and returning from the church, we passed people working on their lawns, this as if nothing had happened. One guy even had his shirt off. Can you beat that? I said to my sister Lisa, not thinking of all the funeral processions that had passed me over the years, me laughing, me throwing stones at signs, me trying to stand on my bicycle seat. Now here I was eating, and it wasn't bad either. The best thing about this particular airline is the after-dinner sundae. The vanilla ice cream is in the bowl already, but you can choose from any number of toppings. I order the caramel and chopped nuts, and the flight attendant spoons them on before my eyes. Is that enough sauce, Mr. Sedaris? She'll ask. And are you sure you don't want some whipped cream? It would be years before I worked up the courage to ask for seconds. And when I finally did, I felt like such a dope. Do you think, is it possible to have another one of those? Well, of course it is, Mr. Sedaris. Have a third if you like. That's business elite for you. Spend $8,000 on a ticket, and if you want an extra 13 cents worth of ice cream, all you have to do is ask. It's like buying a golf cart and having a few tees thrown in. But still, it works. Golly, I say. Thanks. In the years before I asked for seconds, my sundae would be savored, each crumb of cashew or walnut eaten separately, the way a bird might. After those were gone, I would recline a bit and start in on the caramel. By the time the ice cream itself was finished, I'd be stretched out flat, watching a movie on my private screen. The control panels for the seats are located on the shared armrest, and it would take me a good 3 or 4 flights before I got the hang of them. On this trip, for instance, I kept mashing the buttons, wondering why they failed to work. Feet up, feet down, head back, head forward. I was 2 seconds from calling the flight attendant when I looked to my right and saw the Polish man keening and bucking against his will. It was then that I realized I had the wrong control panel. Sorry about that, I said. And he held up his pan-sized hand, the way you do when you mean no hard feelings. When my empty bowl was taken away, I leafed through the in-flight magazine, biding my time until my neighbor's dizziness wore off and he could fall asleep. In an effort to appear respectful, I'd already missed the first movie cycle, but I didn't know how much longer I could hold out. Up ahead, in the cheerful part of Business Elite, someone laughed. It wasn't the practiced chuckle you offer in response to a joke, but something more genuine, a bark almost. It's the noise one makes when watching stupid movies on a plane, movies you probably never laugh at in the theater. I think it's the thinness of the air that weakens your resistance. A pilot will offer some shop-worn joke, and even the seasoned flyers will bust a gut. The only funny announcement I've ever heard was made by a male flight attendant, a queen, who grabbed the microphone as we were taxiing down the runway in San Francisco. Those of you standing in the aisles should have an excellent view of the fastened seatbelt sign, he said. My memory of him and his stern, matronly voice was interrupted by my seatmate, who seemed to have suffered a setback. The man was crying again, not loudly, but steadily, and I wondered, perhaps unfairly, if he wasn't overdoing it a bit. Stealing a glance at his blocky, tear-stained profile, I thought back to when I was 15, and a girl in my junior high died of leukemia, or love story disease, as it was often referred to then. The principal made the announcement, and I, along with the rest of my friends, fell into a great show of mourning. Group hugs, bouquets laid near the flagpole. I can't imagine what it would have been like had we actually known her. Not to brag, but I think I took it hardest of all. Why her and not me? I wailed. Funny, my mother would say, but I don't remember you ever mentioning anyone named Monica. My friends were a lot more understanding, especially Barbara, who, a week after the funeral, announced that maybe she would kill herself as well. None of us reminded her that Monica had died of a terminal illness, as in a way that didn't matter anymore. The point was that she was gone, and our lives would never be the same. We were people who knew people who died. This is to say that we had been touched by tragedy and had been made special by it. By all appearances, I was devastated, but in fact, I had never felt so purposeful and fulfilled. The next time someone died, it was a true friend, a young woman named Dana, who was hit by a car during our first year of college. My grief was genuine, yet still, no matter how hard I fought, there was an element of showmanship to it. The hope that someone might say, "You look like you just lost your best friend." Then I could say, "As a matter of fact, I did." My voice cracked and anguished. It was as if I'd learned to grieve by watching television. Here you cry. Here you throw yourself upon the bed. Here you stare into the mirror and notice how good you look with a tear-drenched face. Like most seasoned phonies, I roundly suspect that everyone is as disingenuous as I am. This Polish man, for instance. Given the time it would take him to buy a ticket and get to JFK, his mother would have been dead for at least 6 hours, maybe longer. Wasn't he over it yet? I mean, really, who were these tears for? It was as if he were saying, "I loved my mother a lot more than you loved yours." No wonder his former seatmate had complained. The guy was so competitive, so self-righteous. So, well, over the top. Another peal of laughter from a few rows up, and it occurred to me that perhaps my sympathy was misplaced. Perhaps these tears of his were the byproduct of guilt rather than sorrow. I envisioned a pale, potato-nosed woman, a tube leaking fluids into her arm. calls were placed, expensive ones, to her only son in the United States. "Come quick," she'd said. But he was too caught up in his own life. Such a hectic time. So many things to do. His wife was getting her stripper's license. He'd been asked to speak at his son's parole board hearing. "I'll tell you what," he said. "I'll come at the end of dog racing season." And then this. She rides to her death on a lumpy gurney, and he flies to her funeral in Business Elite. The man killed his mother with neglect. And because of that, I can't watch a movie on a plane? I pulled my private screen from its hiding place in my armrest and had just slipped on my headphones when the flight attendant came by. "Are you sure I can't get you something to eat, mister?" She looked down at her clipboard and made a sound like she was gargling with stones. The Polish man shook his head no, and she regarded me with disappointment, as if it had been my job to stoke his appetite. "I thought you were different," her eyes seemed to say. I wanted to point out that at least I hadn't complained. I hadn't disrespected his grief by activating my screen either. But I did once she'd returned back into the darkness. Of the four movies playing, I had already seen three. The other was called Down to Earth and starred Chris Rock as an aspiring stand-up comic. One day he gets hit and killed by a truck, and after a short spell in heaven, he's sent back among the living in the body of an elderly white man. The reviews had been tepid at best, but I swear I had never seen anything funnier. I tried not to laugh. I really did. But that's a losing game if there ever was one. This I learned while I was growing up. I don't know why it was exactly, but nothing irritated my father quite like the sound of his children's happiness. Group crying he could stand, but group laughter was asking for it, especially at the dinner table. The problem was that there was so much to laugh at, particularly during the years that our Greek grandmother lived with us. Had we been older, it might have been different. The poor thing has gas, we might have said. For children, though, nothing beats a flatulent old lady. What made it all the crazier was that she wasn't embarrassed by it. No more than our collie Duchess was. It sounded as if she were testing out a chainsaw. Yet her face remained inexpressive and unchanging. "Something funny?" our father would ask. This as if he hadn't heard. As if his chair, too, had not vibrated in the aftershock. "You think something's funny, do you?" If keeping a straight face was difficult, saying no was so exacting it caused pain. "So you were laughing at nothing?" "Yes," we would say. "At nothing." Then would come another mighty rip. And what was once difficult would now be impossible. My father kept a heavy serving spoon next to his plate, and I can't remember how many times he brought it down on my head. "You still think there's something to laugh about?" Strange that being walloped with a heavy spoon made everything seem funnier. But there you have it. My sisters and I would be helpless, doubled over, milk spraying out our mouths and noses. The force all the stronger for having been bottled up. There were nights when the spoon got blood on it. Nights when hairs would stick to that blood. But still our grandmother farted. And still we laughed until the walls shook. Could that really have been 40 years ago? The thought of my sisters and me so young then and so untroubled was sobering. And within a minute, Chris Rock or no Chris Rock, I was the one crying on the night flight to Paris. It wasn't my intention to steal anyone's thunder. A minute or two was all I needed. But in the meantime, here we were, two grown men in roomy seats, each blubbering in his own elite puddle of light. Thank you. I had to, for some reason, now with technology being what it is, you can make a book in no time at all. But publishers want you to turn your book in like 9 months before it comes out. And I've been very lucky to have the publisher that I have, and they've always been very patient with me. I tend to turn my book in March for a release in June. And it feels really good to... I was going to read something here that I wrote after I turned my book in. Oh, here it is. It's just... You know, when you turn a book in, then you just sort of think, well, now what? But at the same time, you feel very free because you could just write whatever you want. You don't have to do anything with it, and you're free for the first time in years. So this is just something that I wrote after I turned my book in. Of the many cliched expressions we Americans tend to overuse, I think the most irritating is, blind people are human too. They are, I guess, but saying it makes you sound preachy and personally involved, as if all your best friends are blind, which they're probably not. I personally don't know any blind people, though the guy I used to buy my newspapers from had pretty bad cataracts. His left eye had a patch over it, and the right one reminded me of the moon in a werewolf movie. This pale blue circle obscured by dense clouds. Still, though, it worked well enough to spot a Canadian quarter. Oh, no, you don't, he said to me. He said to me the last time I bought something. Then he actually grabbed my hand, as if I were a common criminal. I pulled my hand back. Well, excuse me. Then I said, I think it's about time I take my business somewhere else. Son of a bitch, blind person. I'm through defending the likes of him. Number two on my irritating expression list is, I'll never forget the time, ... People say this to me and I think, yawn, am I ever in for a boring story? Take this 4th of July party, for instance, the one thrown every year at the apartment complex I live at. I went last summer, and it was me, this guy who lives next door, and a woman from the ground floor all standing around the pool. The fireworks had ended, and all of a sudden, out of nowhere, my neighbor looks into the water saying, I'll never forget the time my 5-year-old daughter drowned. The woman from the ground floor put her hand on the guy's shoulder. Oh, my God, she said. That's the saddest thing I ever heard in my life. I, meanwhile, was standing there thinking that you should never say never. Especially in regards to what you'll remember. People get older, and you'd be surprised by what they forget. Like, for example, a few weeks back, I called my mother to wish her a happy birthday, her 80th. I bet you wish that Dad was still alive, I said. That way the two of you could celebrate together. But he is still alive, she said. He is? Well, of course, she told me. Who do you think answered the phone? Here I am, just turned 50, and I forgot that my father isn't dead yet. In my defense, though, he's pretty close to it. Health-wise, he's fine, a regular horse. But he doesn't go to that place anymore, the what do you call it that paid him to do stuff? His job. He got too old to do his job, so now he travels around, he and my mother, in one of those winged tubes you see in the sky sometimes. Oh, you know what I'm talking about. Pretty girls used to serve food on them. Planes. They fly around in planes. I'll never forget the time we went to Laos, my father will say. I'll never forget the weekend we spent in Cairo. There was a time when I'd ask him why. What's so special about Cairo? What is it about Laos that makes it so memorable? Then he'd say every time, it's not the place or the people or the food. It's all the great lovemaking your mother and I did there. Then I'd be like, Dad, please, you're old, yuck. It's the same thing my own kids used to say. Then my wife left me, so all my sex talk was about women they knew but weren't related to. Teachers, babysitters. My son's boss when he worked at that steakhouse. What did you sleep with her for? He and his sisters would ask. Can't you find someone who has nothing to do with us? It got so tiresome, I stopped having sex altogether. And that, I think, leads to the most irritating, overused expression of all. I can't remember what it is right now. But believe me, you've probably said it yourself at least 1,000 times. I was just going to read a few little things from my diary here. They're all fairly recent, so I wasn't going to name the year. I was just going to name the day and the city. November 24th, London. Listed in the Guardian newspaper under books with terrible titles, Hugh noted, cooking with poo. This as in Winnie the... October 30th, Seattle. The airport in Bend, Oregon is very small, and while waiting in the security line, I examined an ad for a golf resort called Pronghorn. On another wall was a mammoth screen touting the Ranch of the Canyons, a housing development. I made note of the places with the best names, but there were plenty more where those came from. On each poster, mountains were silhouetted against a cloudless blue sky. A hawk or elk gazed with approval at a new multi-million-dollar home, while someone with a golf cart shielded his eyes against the perfection of the green. So caught up was I in the advertisements that I lost track of the real world. All of a sudden, I was at the front of the line, and a security screener was asking for my ticket and ID. She was a bored-looking woman in her late 20s, and noticing the badge pinned to her shirt pocket, I was struck by how false and real estate-y her name was. Are you really Misty Roebuck? I asked. Then, for good measure, the Misty Roebuck? November 19th, London. Yesterday's Guardian included a profile of Ricky Hatton, the current welterweight champion of the world. He can talk about anything, but I especially like him on the subject of his father, a man who stands only 5 feet tall and looks, his son says, like he just fell off a fucking key ring. May 19th, London. According to Frank Rich in last Sunday's New York Times, the Republicans had just decided on their national campaign slogan, "The Change You Deserve," when they found it was already being used for Effexor, an antidepressant. January 13th, Chicago. Hugh's friend John sat through my reading yesterday. And afterwards, he, a fellow named Stewart, and I went to an Italian restaurant not far from the theater. John just returned from a month-long trip to China, and throughout our meal, he showed us pictures stored on his iPhone. The landscapes were haunting, but they didn't make me want to go, not that that was his goal. If anything, John put me more off than I already was, especially in regards to the food. I did not have a single meal worth praising, he said. Not a one. I asked for specifics, and he mentioned a town I had never heard of. He and a Chinese guide were sitting in a restaurant when a group of men began to chant, the way you might after your team had won a victory. They went to get a closer look and saw, in the middle of the table, a monkey the size of a full-grown cat. Its hands and feet were bound with cords, and as they approached, one of the men hit it over the head with what John called a shillelagh. Then some scalp was pulled away, and using chopsticks, the men ate the monkey's brain. This while it sat there docilely and blinked. "Get out of here," Stuart said. "No," John told us. "It's true." I sensed it was my turn to say something. And so I asked what I thought to be the operative question. Where on earth did they get a shillelagh? April 4th, Paris. I looked at the place where we're staying in Athens and found the following description. Caressing the foot of Lycabettus Hill, the Periscope Hotel is set amidst a flurry of history and the capital of the cradle of civilization. Kolonaki is the name given to the neighborhood, which envelops the hotel and is one of the most famous in Athens. At the confluence of the city's culture, art, design, fashion, and business, this hotel allows you to step to the authentic rhythm of the Athenian pulse, a hip experience you will never forget. Listed under amenities, beneath direct dial telephone and minibar, is written, different types of pillows. October 19th. Normal, Illinois. There's a Target across the highway from my hotel, and I was there looking for pens when I came upon an aisle marked Halloween Alley. This was where the candy was, and these dinky two-sip cans of Coke and Sprite. Mini sodas, I guess you could call them. I was just thinking of buying some when a motion-detecting life-size skeleton piped up from the wall behind me. "Nice Halloween mask," he said. Then, "Oh, that's your face!" What made him so funny was his accent. That and the fact that he really seemed to tickle himself. At the end of every sentence, the skeleton would let loose a bark of laughter and follow it by rolling out his tongue. "I'd go inside with you, but I don't have the guts!" I'm sure there are funnier things in life. But at that moment, standing in the Target with a dinky cola in my hand, I'd be damned if I could think of them. November 15th, London. Harrods has opened a Krispy Kreme counter, and before sitting down to a donut and a cup of coffee, I went to the basement to use the restroom. There was a young man beside me at the urinal, and after he had finished and walked to the sink to wash his hands, the attendant asked him if he'd flushed. "Yeah," the young man said. "No, you didn't," the attendant told him. The young man returned, and as he pulled the handle, we exchanged that particular glance, meaning, "The washroom attendant is crazy." His was the sort of behavior you'd expect at a public toilet in Paris, but not at a department store, especially such a fancy one. The attendant was black and looked to be in his 60s. His accent suggested that he was from the West Indies, and his expression said, in no uncertain terms, that he hated these toilets and everyone who used them. When it came my turn, I made a great show of flushing, glaring at the urinal and its contents as if to say, "Begone, you!" Then I washed up. There were towels folded beside the sink, but using one might have angered the attendant. And so instead, I wiped my hands on my pants. This seemed to please the man. And I left the restroom thinking, "He likes me!" May 26, Paris. A stranger in the Woodlands, Texas, checked Me Talk Pretty one day from her local library and found the following report card folded between the pages. Embalming 2, A. Mortuary Law, B. Forensic Pathology, B. Restorative Art, A. Funeral Merchandising, D. U.S. History, incomplete. It's always a bad sign when the bookmark is more compelling than the book. October 15th, Canton, Michigan. I met a flight attendant at last night's book signing, and during our brief conversation, she taught me a new term. You know how a plastic bottle of water will get all crinkly during a flight, she asked? Well, that happens to people, too, to our insides. That's why we get all gassy. All right, I said. So what me and the other gals will sometimes do is fart while we walk up and down the aisle. No one can hear it on account of the engine noise. But anyway, that's what we call crop dusting. April 4th, Paris. In need of jokes beginning with, a man walks into a bar, I looked on the interweb and found the following. A ham sandwich walks into a bar and orders a drink. Sorry, says the bartender, we don't serve food here. A guy with dyslexia walks into a bra. A pair of battery jumper cables walks into a bar. The bartender says, you can come in, but you better not start anything. A bear walks into a bar and says, I'd like a beer and a packet of peanuts. The barman says, why the big pause? A baby seal walks into a bar. What can I get you? Asks the bartender. And the baby seal answers, anything but a Canadian club. Thank you. Thank you so much for coming.
That's all for tonight's Author on Tour. I'm Darren Fote, and we have been podcasting live from the Tattered Cover Bookstore in Denver, Colorado. Stay pod tuned in the coming weeks for David Guterson, Andre DeBus III, and many more as we podcast Authors on Tour. This podcast was originally recorded on June 22nd, 2008.